in early November when Army was host to Lombardi's old team, Fordham. The Rams came to West Point with much to prove. They'd run through the season unbeaten to that point, surprising even themselves, and an upset of Army would bring national recognition for the first time since Sleepy Jim Crowley's final year at Fordham before World War II. Fordham's best players had played for Lombardi and wanted to show their old mentor that they could excel without him. This group included Joe Lombardi, who'd transferred to Fordham only after his older brother's departure. Then there was the coach, Ed Danowski, to whom the game was a venue for revenge against the former aide who had tried to overthrow him. "We went up there with a chip on our shoulder," said Herb Seidel, Fordham's center. In a sense, Tim Cohane was responsible for it all. In his strategic position as Fordham alumnus and Blake confidant, he'd pressured both sides to schedule the game, thinking the prestigious opponent would help Fordham regain national stature. As was his custom, Cohane drove to West Point from his home in Scarsdale, New York, several hours before kickoff, singing college fight songs all the way up, and went directly to the press box to take in the thrill of a football Saturday. This was his notion of heaven on earth. No sight stirred him more than Mitchie Stadium and its environs along the Hudson. "They have likened its beauty to the Stade in ancient Athens," he once wrote in a letter to a friend. "The gridiron, running north and south, as well-groomed as the front lawn of a palace. Along the west side, a tier of concrete stands roofless, slopes up to the wooded hills, and extends around to both end zones, forming a square-cut letter C. Atop the steep wooded hill to the north sits old Fort Putnam, first built in 1798. Mitchie was built less for size than for beauty. The spectator in the west stand repeatedly catches himself looking beyond to the breathtaking backdrop of the road, the reservoir, the knoll, the observatory, the colonial homes, and the cadet chapel. So much for the splendor of the setting. When the game started and Fordham and Army went at each other, there was nothing beautiful to be seen. Army eventually won 35-0, but the score was secondary. The fight was the game. Even Cohane had to confess that it was more brawl than football, as he wrote later in Look. With a complete disregard for the sensibilities of the assemblage, including the Jesuits and the Army brass, the cadets and the Rams went to work on each other with everything short of stilettos and strangling cords. Doug Kenna remembered the game as probably the roughest I'd ever experienced in college football. "There were penalties all over, and most of them for unnecessary roughness. I always sensed that part of it was because of Lombardi. Fordham wanted to show him." "True enough," said Joe Lombardi. He felt that way about his big brother that day. "It was terrible, and it was because of Vince's leaving and going to West Point. We wanted to show we could play them, but we just fought." We do or die, taken literally. Seidel, the Fordham captain, who had been a strong Lombardi supporter during the power struggle with Danowski, said he got the hell kicked out of him by Army. They called it the Donnybrook on the Hudson. "I was told that 17 teeth came out of 9 different mouths. I lost one. I got my whole face pranged when I was blindsided coming off the field after a punt." That was the kind of game it was. One sports writer acknowledged that he enjoyed the melee. "I hope there will be no hollering, bellowing, nor deploring over the Army-Fordham game. After all, boys will be boys." Frank Graham wrote in his game column for the New York Sun. But the brotherly feud was not dismissed so easily by the antagonists. Even Lombardi and Cohane found themselves in a shouting match afterwards over who started the mess. At a post-game dinner at Blake's house, Cohane chided Lombardi and said Army precipitated the fighting. Lombardi said his alma mater was responsible. Blake, as Cohane recalled it, adopted the attitude of one who had been treated contemptuously by an old friend. But in the end, Lombardi took a lasting lesson from that game that had nothing to do with the fighting. For the rest of his career, he would remember how Fordham reacted late in the second quarter when it was trailing 7-0. Fordham panicked, Lombardi said years later. Twice in a row, the Rams tried to score quickly with passes and were intercepted both times, leading to quick Army scores. Instead of trailing by 7 points at halftime, they faced an insurmountable 3-touchdown disadvantage. I never forgot this, Lombardi said. From then on, whenever a quarterback pleaded for a last-minute touchdown strike before the half, Lombardi said no, remembering Fordham's 1949 collapse at Michi Stadium. The season ended perfectly for Army, with a 38-0 thrashing of Navy, and Blake's maligned but victorious squad won the Lambert Trophy as the best team in the East. After two glum losing years on Rose Hill, Lombardi was feeling the thrill of work and play again. At the postseason luncheon honoring the team, Red Blake seemed untroubled by the controversy that had stalked him all year. He confessed that before the season began, he had thought about retiring, but now he was glad he'd stayed. "You have to pay the price," was his favorite motto, and he felt that he and his team had done so, and we're now reaping the reward. "Once in a while, you are lucky enough to have the thrill and satisfaction of working with a group of men who are willing to make every sacrifice to achieve a goal, and then experience the achieving of it with them," Blake said. "In this, believe me, there is a payment that cannot be matched in any other pursuit." Duty, honor, country, football. What about family? The Lombardis were given a house at 1101 Bartlett Loop on the Academy Post, a cul-de-sac known informally as Coach's Loop. Most of the staff lived there, including the effervescent Red Reader, who had a son about the same age as the Lombardi boy, and three daughters with whom young Vincent was infatuated. West Point was so different from Englewood. Exotic and contradictory, rules about everything, and yet wild and free, with a foreboding sense of danger and mortality. World War II was 4 years distant by the time the Lombardis arrived, but lingering in the culture. Most of the officers, like Red Reader, had fought the Nazis in Europe. Their wives had been transformed by enduring 4 years on the post alone. They were accustomed to running the house without men. The kids tended to be independent, if not forgotten. "We probably fought a bit more than other kids," recalled Russell Reeder III, who was 9 years old when young Vincent moved in down the street and became his first West Point pal. "We probably had less support from our parents. It was an awkward place, but a wonderful place at the same time." Most wondrous was the sense of freedom. Maybe it was the times or maybe the community, but you could go anywhere and do anything. Remembered Russell's sister, Julia. Hide-and-seek up at Fort Putt. Sardines in the cadet chapel. Swimming in the academy pool. Tennis courts. Young Vincent rode his bike everywhere and always found something to watch. Cadets marching across the plain. The football team practicing on the nearby field. A baseball game. Colonel Reeder, the assistant coach, hitting fungos on a prosthetic leg, hurdlers scraping by at a track meet. Once young Vincent walked into the officers' club and ordered a hamburger and milkshake and put it on the old man's tab. This life, he thought, was an ideal deal. Until his father examined the monthly bill, that is, and quickly put a stop to the freeloading. "Geez," Vincent said decades later, remembering the scene, "he'd like to have taken my head off." By the time young Vincent entered third grade, some of the roughness of the place had rubbed off on him. Wanting to be considered one of the guys, he became a goof-off in school, and one day was ordered from his seat in the back of class to sit in confinement in the well under the teacher's desk. At recess, he made his escape and walked off the school property unnoticed. His teacher reported him missing when the class returned inside. School officials called Marie at home and Vince at the gymnasium. The post was mobilized to find Coach Lombardi's son. Had he been kidnapped? Students who could recognize him were taken out of class to help MPs comb the grounds. For hours, as the frantic search continued into surrounding woods, young Vincent sat hidden from view in the back of an old abandoned building near their house on the loop, unaware of the commotion, taking in the sun, chewing on a stalk of grass. Near the end of the day, he got to his feet and walked over to his house and calmly said hello to his little sister and frantic mother. It was never easy being the namesake son of Vince Lombardi. That childhood moment of rebellion came to symbolize young Vincent's lifelong dilemma, trying to find his own quiet place in the sun. To say that Lombardi was a strict father at West Point would be accurate and misleading. He had no qualms about hitting his son as punishment for apparent wrongdoing. The backhand thwacks of his mother, Matty, imprinted on his brain as an effective means of discipline. But mostly, Lombardi was missing. He was largely an absentee father and husband, when not physically, then emotionally. At work from 8 a.m. until late into the night, away on road trips with the team, or recruiting prospective cadets in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Wisconsin. He found himself trapped in the snowdrifts of Green Bay on a recruiting mission with Doug Kenna and muttered, "Can you imagine living in this godforsaken place?" When he did spend an evening at home, it often seemed to his family that he wasn't there, especially during spring drills, fall practice, and the regular season, half of every year. The dining room was his extra office, strewn with papers, thick with smoke, 2 ashtrays crammed with cigarette butts before the night was out, 3 packs a day, 4 cartons a week, as he diagrammed plays and planned what he would tell his troops the next day. 10 years into their marriage, even after all those years at Saints and Fordham, Marie was still uncertain about her place in Vince's football life. She desperately sought more of his time and attention, and alternately loved and hated the game that possessed him, now embracing it as the most effective means of reaching Vince, now rejecting it roundly as the temptress that lured her husband away from her. She often strolled down to the practice field to watch Vince lead the cadets through drills. The practices were open to the public, and many wives and professors came out to see them. Blake, by nature a secretive man, never liked the tradition, and largely ignored the well-wishers. Lombardi was more gregarious, though not with Marie. Once she returned from a trip to Manhattan with Doug Kenna's wife wearing a tight new knit suit, and was delighted with her thin and striking appearance, until Vin looked over at her and ruined her mood, shouting loud enough for heads to turn, "God, Marie, you look like a sausage!" If Marie was embarrassed, she didn't take this abuse meekly. She just leveled him. I mean totally leveled him with words, said Doug Kenna, who'd been standing next to Vince on the field. Marie yearned for social standing. She wanted to be accepted by the elite and appreciated that West Point was a notch up the social ladder from Englewood. With other football wives, she made periodic trips to Manhattan, where they shopped on Fifth Avenue and dined at Leone's on West 48th Street, the boisterous Italian restaurant run by Jean Leone, who was Army fan number 2, if MacArthur was number 1. Leone, whose son-in-law was a popular major at West Point, had been made an honorary member of the class of 1915, Eisenhower's class. He bought a nearby estate, catered at least 1 gourmet meal a year to the gang at Bull Pond, and made his restaurant the New York headquarters for all West Point officers and football coaches. Their wives were golden at Leone's, free parking in the lot, best tables and service. Marie enjoyed the special attention, but just as in Englewood, her Manhattan interludes could not fill the void, nor could her children. She spent more time with young Vincent and Susan than Vince did, but she wasn't a doting mother. Rearing children was largely a distraction to her. She wanted to be with Vince and adults. It was the talk of the post once, when little Susie wandered off unnoticed by her mother, until a minister called and said he'd found the toddler stark naked and crying inside his church. Marie's drinking worsened at West Point. She attended several Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and sought other counseling to help her deal with the frustrations of married life. A lot of Army wives used to drink too much. They'd have these coffee clatches or liquor clatches in the early afternoons, said Vince's middle brother, Harold, who had long been Marie's confidant. A lot of Marie's drinking came because she idolized Vin and he was off with his own little group. Marie spent many hours over at the Reader House unloading her problems on Reader's wife, Dort. Daughter Julia Reader would eavesdrop. One day she heard Marie say, "Dort, I figured it out. He really is easy to live with, as long as he's not thinking about football." Which meant not often enough. When Vince was in a loving mood, sometimes his timing was off. Once at a tea for Army Athletic Association wives, Marie confessed that her husband was always in a rush. "Last week he came home from the football office at 11 a.m. when I was baking a cake. He wanted to make love to me and got flour all over both of us." For the most part, the outside world knew little of this. Vince and Marie were considered a fun-loving couple. In social settings, Lombardi was almost universally regarded as warm and jovial. Margaret Cohane, Tim's wife, considered him very much a man's man, who paid little attention to the women in a room, but even she was taken by his enthusiasm, especially that wonderful laugh that would start way down low and then expand. Vince was the godfather of the Cohane's third child, Mary Teresa. He seemed especially friendly with children other than his own. During the summer months, families in the athletic department got together for ice cream socials, with 5-cent movies and badminton tournaments, and Uncle Vince was always right there playing with the kids. Of course, he couldn't just hit the shuttlecock back and forth. "If he was going to play, it had to be competition, a real game," said Russell Reeder. But his good-natured participation was appreciated nonetheless. When Doug Kenna's wife came to football practice with their 6-month-old daughter, Vince made a beeline to her and started dancing around the practice field singing, "Tut-tut-tootsie goodbye, tut-tut-tootsie don't cry." The Kenna girl was known by her family as Tootsie for the rest of her life. Lombardi certainly had strong feelings for family. Harry and Mattie drove up from Englewood every few weeks, old 5x5 hauling a few thick, delicious fillets from the meat market, and various Izzo cousins were also frequent guests. Jim Lawler, his roommate from Fordham, and several Englewood friends often dropped in. One of young Vincent's strongest memories of West Point was of his father and Tim Cohane sitting on the couch in the living room late at night, talking and talking and talking. Tim did most of the talking. He was probably the forerunner of Howard Cosell, one of those guys who always had an opinion, and it sounded better by virtue of the way he delivered it, with his deep, authoritative, melodious voice. Vincent and Susan were sometimes puzzled by how talkative their father could be with other people, how cuddly he was with other kids, in contrast to the way he acted at home. He wasn't the same person with them that he was with his players and friends. There were times when the wife and kids wondered whether they were at fault, somehow not living up to the concept of family that Vince carried with him from his childhood in Sheepshead Bay. The '50s. Nothing placid about the way the new decade began at West Point. By the end of June 1950, America was at war again, and many of the cadets who had played on the fields of friendly strife were now on muddy fields in Korea, led by General MacArthur, Supreme Commander, Allied Powers, Commander of United Nations Military Forces, fighting the North Koreans and Communist Chinese. At the academy, casualty lists were posted weekly, many of the names all too familiar to the cadets. As the football season opened in September, word arrived of the combat death of Tom Lombardo, captain of the 1944 national championship team. The players were distracted by events in Korea from then on. As part of his hazing duties as a plebe that year, Lowell Sisson, a tenderfoot end from Waterloo, Iowa, had to report to an upperclassman's room every day before meal formation, where he stood in stiff brace at the doorway and summarized all the dispatches from Korea in that morning's New York Times. All the seniors knew they might be over there in a few months, Sisson recalled. It was a very tense time for them. Even in that anxious state of mind, the football team began the season performing better than it had the year before. Lombardi, whom Blake had entrusted with the cadet offense, devoted himself to the development of the coach's son, Bob Blake, Galifa's replacement at quarterback, and the effort paid off. Bob became the leader of a team that routed Michigan again and shut out five teams as it rolled through the first seven games undefeated. For the eighth game, Army took its first road trip by air out to California to play Stanford. It had rained unceasingly in Northern California, and the game was played in a blinding downpour, the field all mud and muck. Bob Blake passed for the lone touchdown. That night, after the 7-0 Army victory, the old man and Lombardi and the rest of the staff partied in Blake's suite at the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco. Tim Cohane was there, along with the aging Granny Rice and a coterie of Eastern writers. They told stories and recited corny epic poems late into the night, Blake and his men exhilarated by what was now a 28-game unbeaten streak. The overconfident cadets had 2 weeks to prepare for the game against Navy, the traditional season-ending rivalry. Scouting reports on the midshipmen had been coming in all year, and they were invariably encouraging. Navy was becalmed, going nowhere in a miserable losing season. All prognostications were of an imminent rout. Blake was nervous, as always, against Navy. The game could ruin an otherwise glorious season. "There was tension among the coaches," Lombardi said later, "but Blake hid the tension from the players." He was nervous, fearing that his players were losing their feel of the game because heavy rains had forced them to practice indoors. Then, a few days before the game, during what was called Navy Week, when Corps enthusiasm usually reached a feverish pitch, a report came in that Johnny Trent was dead, killed in action earlier that month in Korea. Trent had been the captain of the 1949 team, and a bullion end from Memphis who had begun the year as a graduate assistant working with the plebe squad before he and classmate Arnold Galifa, the quarterback, were sent across the Pacific with the Third Army. The ever-increasing sad news from Korea, which has been brought closer to the cadets than to any group in the land, Blake said, had relegated thoughts of the Navy game to second place. Perhaps they were excuses. The Navy team, which had received brilliant scouting reports on Army and played flawlessly, might have won anyway that day, and win they did, 14-2. There was a touch of poetic justice to the upset. Army was beaten at its own strong-arm game. "The Navy beat us, and beat is the proper word, as our men took a physical beating which completely bewildered them," Blake wrote later in a long letter to MacArthur. "Gilbert Reich, our only safety, went out the first 5 minutes of play and did not clear mentally until late Saturday night. Ordinarily, we use 3 or 4 ammonia inhalers during a game, but against Navy, our trainers used 4 dozen boxes. With Reich out, the only long pass for a score which had been made against the cadets in several years was completed. It was the play that gave Navy a surge which could not be denied." It's doubtful that Blake's lament moved MacArthur much in this instance, for at the same time that Army was losing to Navy, MacArthur's United Nations forces were at the Yalu River in Korea, suffering a loss of incomparably greater dimensions. MacArthur, convinced that the Red Chinese would not enter the war, or if they did, that it would be without much firepower, had pushed his troops to the Korea-China border. He ended up leading his men into a trap, and 3,000 soldiers from the 2nd Infantry Division were killed or wounded as they retreated south through a gauntlet of Red Chinese guns firing down into the valley, clogged with abandoned vehicles and the bloody detritus of war. Hardly in the same realm as Blake's 4 dozen boxes of ammonia inhalers in the Navy game. If there was a comparison to be made, it was that both the coach and his favorite general were victims of their own success. On the Special Academy train returning to West Point from the Army-Navy game in Philadelphia, Blake entered a compartment shared by his assistants, Lombardi, Warmoth, and Kenna. He appeared utterly disconsolate. "I want to talk to you," he said in a deep, low voice. To Lombardi and Warmoth's relief, he was looking at Kenna. Kenna knew that he was in trouble. He was in charge of the defensive backs, and they had been beaten on some key plays. I thought he was going to chew me out, but he really didn't. He explained it was my fault, but that was that. He was in agony and wanted to talk to somebody. I sat and listened to him all the way back to West Point, Kenna said later. I don't think Blake ever lost a game that hurt that much. In his letter to MacArthur explaining the loss, Blake acknowledged the depth of his despair. There are many who had said that it is well that a friendly series such as ours should be more even, but I confess that there is no philosophy in me that accepts such a theory, he wrote. We got the heck kicked out of us, and there is much to be done at West Point before we can get into the win column. More. Much more than Blake then realized. Chapter 7 Blake's Boys. An unraveling had begun. The loss to Navy lingered at West Point for months, largely because of Blake, who remained inconsolable. He could not forget what had happened that bleak afternoon in Philadelphia, nor would he allow himself to try. He might as well have installed a navy blue neon sign on his furrowed forehead, flashing night and day, 14-2, 14-2. He compulsively rehashed the loss and replayed the game films, looking for explanations. He had viewed the pictures and studied the individual performances of each man until the game is close to a nightmare. He confessed in a letter to General Dwight D. Eisenhower, the West Point alumnus, who by then had become the president of Columbia University. Blake's assistants had seen the game so many times that they had memorized the precise sequence from kickoff to final gun, every mistake, every moment when Blake predictably stopped the film to draw an agonizing lesson one more time. It became ritualized, a morality play performed daily in the darkness of the projection room. The staff sat in the same seats and repeated yesterday's dialogue. Once Murray Warmoth blurted something out of turn and was chided by Lombardi. Hey, you stole my line! Navy was not supposed to win the game. They had not beaten Blake's boys since 1943, but somehow, every time the film ran to completion, the final score came out the same. Anything was possible now. The Blakeian world of balance, order and certitude seemed shaken and vulnerable to collapse. In football, there's a natural tendency to develop an us-versus-them complex. But now, them was not just Navy. Blake believed there were forces inside West Point, especially officers in the tactical department, seeking to undermine his program and rid the academy of his best players. He noticed a warning sign before 1951's spring drills began in March, when Warmoth accompanied several players to Manhattan for dinner at Leone's. During the meal, a West Point officer approached their table and berated the athletes, saying their social skills were embarrassingly deficient. As Warmoth described the confrontation to Blake, the coach mused aloud that the message was meant not for his free-spirited boys, so much as for him. He already seemed besieged when he received word the following month of a casualty on the political battleground. On April 11th, his hero, MacArthur, was summarily fired from supreme command in the Far East by President Truman. The move was predictable, yet shocking to the general's acolytes. For months, MacArthur had defiantly challenged military and foreign policy directives from the Pentagon and White House, pushing his troops beyond the defined limits in Korea and declaring that the United States had been too cautious in its dealings with China. Blake was among his most ardent supporters. Hours after the dismissal, he cabled MacArthur at Tokyo headquarters. "American public is stunned. Time is of the essence to offset administration hatchetmen. My affection and devotion to you." In the weeks that followed, when he was not sitting in the darkness of the tower witnessing grainy footage of the Navy fiasco, Blake busied himself with the task of ensuring that his favorite old soldier did not fade away. He believed that the best solution was for MacArthur to become the Republican candidate for president in 1952. Employing the metaphors of his sports universe, he wrote MacArthur that the best hope for the future lies in fielding a new team in Washington. American military policy in Asia, he said, was comparable to a football team with a strong ground game and air game, always punting on first down, and through fear, presenting the initiative to the opponent. Not long after MacArthur's forced return, Blake visited him at his suite in exile atop the Waldorf Astoria Towers in Midtown Manhattan. At that meeting, Blake argued that the general, then 71, was not too old to run for president. "The years have touched you so lightly," he wrote in a follow-up letter, and belittled the potential candidacy of MacArthur's longtime military competitor, General Eisenhower. As solicitous as the ever-political Blake was in his separate running correspondence with Eisenhower, his private opinions of Ike were cutting. "I like Ike. We all like Ike, but not as president," he wrote to one political associate that year. He called Eisenhower the world's foremost compromiser, which in the political lexicon he had adopted from MacArthur was intended as a wounding insult. Lombardi watched Blake's maneuvers with only moderate interest. He was intrigued by Blake's readiness to transfer his philosophy to the political realm, awed by the strength of MacArthur's rhetoric, but less impressed with the specific politics. Since his days among the Jesuits on Rose Hill, Lombardi had been a Democrat, and he shared with fellow Fordham grad Tim Cohane, also a Democrat, an ability to draw lifelong lessons from Blake's philosophy and style without becoming submissive to his beliefs, to revere St. Blake without following him blindly. The spring of 1951 was a difficult time to follow him at all. Given Blake's state of mind, agitated by the Navy loss and MacArthur's undoing, it was providential that Lombardi could escape West Point for a while. The opportunity came late in April, when he and five other members of the Army athletic staff were dispatched to the Orient to conduct football clinics. It began as a merry junket. The coaches lounged in luxury suites at the Mark Hopkins Hotel in San Francisco before boarding an old military transport plane that took them across the Pacific to Tokyo. The trip had been arranged before MacArthur's recall, during the days when he was trying to instill in the Japanese the traditions of American culture and democracy. The introduction of football, MacArthur thought, might ease the process. Lombardi and his colleagues were not burdened with the mission of selling democracy. Their goal was to teach football and enjoy the sights. Kenna, who had made several recruiting forays with Lombardi in the States, wasn't surprised to discover that Vince had connections in Tokyo. It seemed that wherever they traveled, there was an old Fordham man, usually an FBI agent. Fordham was a dependable supplier of federal gumshoes, who knew the best places in town. Here it was even better. Vince found a Fordham man in charge of the officers' clubs in Tokyo. Vin and I toured quite a few night spots that the other guys didn't get to, Kenneth said later. We had a good time. This guy took us everywhere. The football instruction was tedious. The Japanese hadn't played American football and were learning the game from scratch. They were earnest, if bewildered, and undersized students, and Lombardi, as ever, was an aggressive teacher. For the most part, the instruction was mental rather than physical, which meant that he generally refrained from his hands-on methods of teaching blocking and tackling, and avoided injuring a student or himself. After 3 weeks in Tokyo, the Army coaches received a surprise telephone call from Arnold Galiffa, the quarterback for the undefeated 1949 team, now a decorated aide to General Matthew Ridgway, who had taken over the supreme command from MacArthur. Galiffa passed along word that the old man, in this case Ridgway, all brass in the military culture were the old man, wanted them to go to Korea and entertain the troops, like a USO tour. Blake would never allow it, Kenna responded. The colonel was uncomfortable having his assistants away this long. Certainly they had more Navy film to examine back at the gym. No problem, Galiffa said. It was already arranged. Ridgway sent a plane to retrieve them in Tokyo and take them to the war zone. Lombardi was dressed in military guise. Army fatigues, at least. No stripes. Green cap askew, though not on backward the way the devilish Warmoth wore it to irritate fuss-budget lieutenants. Their first experience in Korea was unnerving. At the landing strip near Seoul, an American jet fighter bomber came in right before them with its bombs jammed and about to explode. At military posts in Korea, they showed game films to the fighting men and told stories about the Army football team, the heroic backfield of Davis and Blanchard, how the cadets seemed loaded again at the recently completed spring drills, oozing with so much talent, said Lombardi, that no one in the country could touch us. From the troops they heard accounts of war and countless tales about MacArthur. They kept the negative comments to themselves and remembered the positive for retelling to Blake back at West Point. Blake treasured few things more than chances to praise and flatter his patron. Indeed, in his first letter to MacArthur after debriefing his assistants, Blake wrote, "This is the part that will interest you a great deal. They spoke with hundreds of soldiers, officers, as well as many civilians in Tokyo and Korea, and from all these sources, without exception, came words of respect and veneration for General MacArthur. Our coaches were amazed that it was so universal." What amazed them more was their nearness to real rather than symbolic warfare. One day the coaches were escorted by army guards to advanced positions held by the 1st Marine Division under the command of Colonel Wilbert S. Bigfoot Brown. Here the distinction between football and war became patently obvious and made any equating of the two seem preposterous. Colonel Blake might draft battle plans in the secrecy of a tower, but he didn't need the protective cover of sandbags piled 10 feet thick like Colonel Brown's command bunker. Troops on the right and left had given way to enemy thrusts. Bigfoot, shoe size 14E, and his Marines were holding the precarious line when the coaches arrived. They were invited to his command bunker for lunch. With lanterns illuminating the scene, the guests sat on canvas cots as a captain prepared meals over a Coleman stove. Beans and Franks. What the hell are we doing here? Warmoth thought to himself. Just as the meal was to be served, an enemy bomb exploded nearby. Powerful concussion. Lanterns knocked out. Mess kits flying. Food tossed. In the chaos of the moment, a shaken Lombardi reached up and felt an awful mess on his scalp. "God!" he shouted. "My brains are coming out!" He really thought he'd been hit, recalled Kenna, who'd been standing a few feet away. Until, that is, he was informed that the hot mush simmering atop his head was not brain matter, but an airborne serving of baked beans. Lombardi's military sojourn had its comic aspect, but it was also truly frightening. He was a civilian facing enemy fire, an experience thousands of servicemen never encountered. After their Korean adventure, the coaches split up for more football clinics. Lombardi was sent to the Philippines with Paul Amon. Kenna and Warmoth went to Okinawa. It was July by then, and they had been away 2 months. Bull Pond would be coming soon, and then fall practice. By the time Lombardi reunited with the others in Tokyo, he seemed eager to return to West Point and begin work with his talented corps. Messages awaited in Tokyo. One from Colonel Blake, urgent. Kenna called the old man, and when he hung up, he reported that Blake was absolutely sick and wanted the staff to get on back as quickly as possible. Something about football players and violations of the Academic Honor Code. Details would come soon enough, but one thing was obvious to the coaches as they scrambled back to West Point. This might be worse than any loss to Navy. This was 1951, the beginning of what was later perceived through the lens of nostalgia as the decade of simplicity. This was West Point, garrison of traditional American values, duty, honor, country. And this was Coach Blake, the old man, demanding and austere. It would be easy for someone nearly 50 years later, discouraged by the corrupted state of sports in America at the end of the 20th century and unmindful of the cycles of history, to take a fleeting look at that combination and make a backward leap of faith. Now there was a time and place where sport was honest and clean, by the rules, when pride still mattered. But history has a way of mocking attempts to render it retroactively pure. That very trinity, 1951, West Point, Red Blake, could also be remembered for one troubling event. A massive Academic Honor Code violation that resulted in, among other things, the devastation of Blake's audacious football squad. Lombardi's role was peripheral. He was there and not there. He lived through the scandal. He survived it unscathed. His name does not appear in a single document related to it, and he rarely spoke of it later in his career as though he had repressed it. But the events of that episode are not immaterial to his larger story. They're central to understanding the mythology of Lombardi, the contradictory demands and expectations of football, and the fallacy of the innocent past. The trouble for Blake's boys began even before Lombardi and the other assistants left for the Far East, blissfully unaware. It was on the morning of April 2nd that an honor representative for the first class, or seniors, visited the office of Colonel Paul D. Harkins and reported that some cadets had formed a ring to pass along unauthorized academic information, meaning questions and answers, for daily quizzes and midterm reviews. The cadet told Harkins that his knowledge of the scheme came originally from a third classman and member of the swim team, whose own familiarity with the ring was more direct. He had been invited to join it. The swimmer believed the ring was operated by football players. After declining the offer to join the conspiracy, he became concerned about reporting fellow cadets, but also realized that failure to do so would be a violation of the honor code. A cadet does not lie, cheat, or steal. A cadet who knows about someone who has lied, cheated, or stolen must report him for violating the code. That was the honor code, as old as West Point and enforced by the cadets themselves. It was revered as the foundation of the Academy's integrity, drilled into every plebe from the first week of orientation at Beast Barracks. Colonel Harkins wrote a memorandum for the record, detailing what he had been told about the ring, and noting that he was indeed shocked to hear of such a thing. As Commandant of Cadets and head of West Point's Tactical Department, Harkins was responsible for transforming college students into soldiers. His background for the job was unquestioned. He'd been trained at the side of General George S. Patton, for whom he had served as Deputy Chief of Staff with the Third Army during World War II, earning a nickname, the Ramrod, that reflected his determination to carry out Patton's wishes. In style and substance, he was more Patton's opposite, unemotional and all by the book. What he excelled at was framing rules and following them. His feelings about Blake and football were decidedly negative. It was Harkins who had confronted Warmoth during dinner at Leone's, offended by the behavior of young officers-to-be. He considered the football department a discredit to the academy. It was favored with special privileges, flouted the rules of the corps, was stocked with athletes who belonged neither in college nor the army, and was led by a coach whose power outstripped his position and whose rank exceeded his merit. Harkins was among the non-believers when it came to St. Blake. The word among these heretics was that Blake was at West Point when he could have been fighting in World War I, and became a colonel as a matter of show. After being recruited from Dartmouth to build the football program, he was recommissioned as an officer, and during the war, insisted on status equal to Navy's coach. It was with that frame of reference that Harkins received the tip that Blake's football squad might be involved in an academic scandal, and he responded with zeal. He quickly called a meeting of his immediate staff. We had no tangible evidence, and knew we would have to get some before we could prove anything, he wrote later in a confidential memorandum. We discussed means and methods. We thought of everything from recording systems and hidden mics to having someone join the ring. They decided to fight fire with fire by asking the swimmer and two other trusted cadets to infiltrate the ring. The swimmer agonized about becoming a stool pigeon. The request, he said later, seemed unfair, unnecessary, and undignified. However, is the West Point yearling privileged to doubt the judgment of the Commandant of Cadets? He contacted an uncle, a corporate lawyer in New York, who drove to West Point that weekend to counsel him. They strolled up the path to Mitchie Stadium and stood by the low wall surrounding Lusk Reservoir as the cadet calmly outlined his dilemma. He said he felt trapped and wanted to quit West Point. His uncle urged him not to leave under fire since he had done nothing wrong. Do as the colonel says. The tormented cadet agreed to go along with Harkin's plan. By early May, the swim team cadet and other informants had gathered solid evidence on a handful of classmates and believed that as many as 50 to 100 cadets were involved, most of them connected to the football team. Unauthorized information about tests, they told Harkins, was being passed freely at the football tables in the dining room. They also said the ringleaders appeared to have rigged the system by strategically placing a few tainted cadets on the 25-member committee that enforced the honor code. Professors of Spanish, math, mechanics, and physics presented Harkins with evidence that test questions in their classes appeared to be known in advance. As the month wore on, rumors spread that a scandal was about to explode. Members of the ring became suspicious of the infiltrators and ostracized them. Harkins decided it was time to act. He went to Major General Frederick A. Irving, the Academy's new superintendent, and received approval to launch an official investigation. Three officers were appointed to a board of inquiry, led by Harkin's ally in the tactical department, Lieutenant Colonel Arthur S. Collins, Jr., who shared his distaste for Blake and big-time Army football. The board targeted 14 cadets suspected of involvement in the ring and brought them in to testify under oath, one by one, starting at 7 o'clock on the morning of May 29th. The first witness was a third classman who confessed immediately. I first heard about this ring during fourth class, his freshman or plebe year in 1949, he began. He went on to say that the ring was started by football players for football players, and that rings operated in both the first and second regiments. The way the process worked, he testified, was that ring members who took a writ, daily quiz, in an early period, would pass along the questions to cadets who were to take the same writ later in the day. If there was time, the answers were then worked out by smarter members of the ring and slipped to cadets who were struggling academically. "Everyone has been scared to death because they've had an idea it's going to break," the cadet said in concluding his testimony. The first witness turned out to be the most forthcoming of the 14. The second said he knew nothing about a cribbing ring. The third said he would not say anything until he talked to Coach Blake. "I'll tell you anything about myself, but if it's football players you're asking about, I won't squeal," he added. "There are people around here who don't like football players. My tactical officer's one of them." The remaining first-day witnesses insisted that they knew nothing of a ring. The next afternoon, as Blake strode across the plain to attend a baseball game, his son Bob played second base, he encountered a football player who nonchalantly mentioned an honor code investigation. To Blake, it sounded minor, perhaps involving one cadet. He learned otherwise that night in an urgent phone call from another player saying that several sophomores needed to see him immediately. At 9:15, he was up in the projection room of the gymnasium tower, listening to 12 of his players tell him about the ring and their appearances before the Board of Inquiry. They said they were confused and would do whatever Blake advised. By all accounts, he directed them to return to the board and tell the whole truth. "You know how we do business in the squad and at the military academy," he said. "Each one of you should state the facts to the board without equivocation." When the players left, Blake remained in the film room, alone in the dark. Lombardi and his other assistants were on the other side of the world. His mentor, MacArthur, was off giving rousing political speeches. "No foreboding could have been greater than my own," Blake later wrote of the dismay that overwhelmed him at that moment. "I had been in many a tough game, but this was not a game. It was a catastrophe." When he left the gymnasium that night, Blake walked next door to Superintendent Irving's house. All lights were out, but Blake couldn't wait until morning. He flung pebbles at a darkened bedroom window, roused Irving from bed, and sat in the Supes' living room recounting his meeting with the players. He pleaded with Irving to take the investigation away from the tactical department, arguing that the situation was too important for young officers to decide. Left unsaid was his concern that the board appointed by Harkins, an antagonist, was unlikely to give Blake's boys a sympathetic hearing. He called Harkins a black-and-white man with no shades of gray. And there was plenty of gray in this situation, Blake maintained. He considered the honor system flawed because of its reliance on squealing, and he thought the academic system even worse, set up almost to ensure that the honor system would fail. Why give the exact same writs to different classes one day to the next? Irving was consoling, but noncommittal. The next morning brought more bad news to the coach. Bob Blake, his son and starting quarterback, confided that he was among those who had violated the honor code. He was a fine student who said he knew about the cribbing but didn't report it. "My God," said father to son, "how could you, how could you?" That same day, the football players who had met with Blake in the projection room notified Lieutenant Colonel Collins that they wished to reappear before his board of inquiry. This time they told the truth. They were followed by more cadets, football players, and others, who also confessed. Suddenly, the board had more information than it could process. The answers to Blake's lament came gushing out. How could they? Their answers, as transcribed by a court stenographer and compiled in the confidential report of the board's proceedings, reveal the full range of human impulses, good and bad. They could violate the honor code out of fear, peer pressure, custom, laziness, academic inadequacy, loyalty, friendship, teamwork. Cadet 1. I did it to stay in the academy. I could not have passed without it. I knew this was a violation of the honor system. But when I knew all these other people had done it, and when I wanted to stay here so much, it was either get help or go home. Cadet 2. At first I tried to be honest, but after doing it a few times, I just let things slide, although I was aware of the honor system and its requirements. My loyalty to my teammates seemed bigger. I was given the impression that the practice was passed on from upperclassmen. The football players tried to keep it among themselves. Someone said there was one man on the honor committee who would warn us in time. Last night, a number of us had a meeting with Coach Blake. He was shocked. He told us to tell the truth, and that is why I am back here. Cadet 3. I know it was wrong, but after all, people cheat in civilian colleges, so we thought it was okay to do it in West Point. Cadet 4. I became aware of it plebe year during spring football. I noticed people talking about academic subjects at the table in the dining hall, but I didn't know what to do about it. I knew it was against honor, but these men were my idols. When I arrived at West Point, they told us to pick out a first-classman and be like him. I picked one, and when I found out he was cheating, it really shocked me. I had thought he stood for everything good. Cadet 5. I know everything. I saw everything. What I told you on the 29th was wrong. Coach Blake told me to tell the truth, and I will do whatever he tells me to. During the summer of 1949, soon after I entered West Point, I was approached by a veteran football player who told me how to do it. You look like a dumb football player, kid. If you have any trouble in academics, remember that the people in other regiments have instruction before you do. Get the poop, then you'll get by. He was the greatest guy in the world to me. I would have done anything he told me to. I know many cadets who couldn't do any problems. When they made good grades on writs, I figured that the instructors knew about it and just let football players get away with it. I couldn't turn all these people in. They were my best friends, and when you play ball together, you just get very close. Besides, when you see all those upperclassmen who you worship doing it, you don't think it's so bad. During the following week, the investigators expanded the probe, calling in cadets from all four classes. The seniors had just returned by train from a training mission at Aberdeen, Maryland, and were to graduate within a week. Although earlier witnesses had implicated members of this first class of 1951, to a man, they denied knowledge of the ring. The investigative panel concluded that a number of the members of this class are believed to have testified falsely, but it cannot be established. They were all allowed to graduate June 5th. The juniors from Bob Blake's class of 1952 were not so lucky. The board called in dozens of members of that class, football players and others, and the portrait of a conspiracy grew wider and darker. Coach Blake and his assistant coaches were never implicated directly, but witnesses spoke of players freely passing the poop in the projection room near Blake's tower and in the locker room. The protective aura surrounding Blake's program, some cadets said, made it easier for the scandal to develop. Cadet A. Passing the poop was a big thing. Everyone in the Corps knows who Blake's boys are, and anyone who tampers with them is in trouble. This is the impression one gets from the first day of Beast Barracks. You even hear remarks like that in the hotel before entrance. It is said that Colonel Blake is so influential that no one had better cross him. Cadet B. Any man on the football, basketball, or baseball corps squad who tells you he didn't know unauthorized information was being passed is either lying or is too dumb to be in West Point. There were so many people in on it that it seemed almost to have official sanction. I heard when I first got here that Blake's boys get by. Cadet C. Colonel Blake has always told the football team that they were the rock on which the Corps was built. This and other similar things had a tendency to set the football team apart from the Corps. I believe the football team is the nucleus of this group. The three-officer panel concluded its hearings the second week of June and filed a confidential report with Colonel Harkins just as the Commandant of Cadets was preparing to leave West Point for a new assignment at the Pentagon. The cheating conspiracy, according to the panel's findings, began as far back as 1947, was centered in and perpetuated by members of the Football Corps squad until the fall of 1950, at which time cheating began to spread, and eventually would have destroyed the honor system at West Point had it continued. The findings listed 90 cadets who had been implicated in the ring for cheating, having knowledge of cheating or lying in sworn testimony, and suggested that they be offered an opportunity to resign and be discharged, immediately expelled, in other words. Among the 90 were all but two members of the varsity football squad. Before sending the report to the superintendent and departing for Washington, Harkins added his own recommendations. Separation from the academy, Harkins emphasized, was the one and only solution for the guilty cadets. He ended his comments with a final shot at Blake and his boys. I am sorry that the exposition of this group had to be my parting act as commandant. However, having discovered it, proved it to be a fact, my duty to the honest cadets, to the academy, and to the country was to expose it, expel it, and let the chips fall where they may. I think when the air clears, the whole thing will have a very salutary effect on West Point and the country. It will bring some of the athletic teams back closer to the Corps of Cadets. It will prove to all of us that, though we want to have winning teams and play to win, the teams must be made up of cadets who are members of the Corps and respect and live by the ideals and spirit of West Point. There can be no other way. In the final analysis, the honor system and the academy will be the gainers, and West Point will continue to live by high ideals and carry its banner with duty, honor, country, emblazoned on its crest at the head of the long gray line. The confidential report moved up the military chain of command from Harkins to Superintendent Irving, who shared it with West Point's academic board, and then sent it along to the Pentagon with his own conclusion on July 2nd, supporting the board's actions. The recommendation of expulsion would stick unless it was countermanded by higher-ups, and Blake worked passionately to try to soften the penalties, urging what he called an intramural solution, in which erring cadets would be disciplined privately within the academy. He tried to recruit MacArthur to help him in this effort, but the general was preoccupied with giving political speeches and unavailable to meet with him. Blake was able to make several trips to Washington and meet informally with Army brass to repeat his case. He told his boys to tell the truth, which they'd done. So why expel them when other cadets, who had blatantly lied, denying any knowledge of the academic cheating, were allowed to remain? The Army would have had difficulty getting enough evidence against most of these boys unless they'd confessed. And the honor system was fatally flawed in any case, Blake insisted, designed not to instill integrity, but to entice cadets to cheat and squeal. During the third week of July, Lombardi, Warmoth, and Kenna returned from Japan. As Blake began to outline the dimensions of the problem to them, he seemed beside himself, they said later, tormented in a way that they had never seen before. West Point was a starkly different place from when they'd left. The granite fortress, symbol of right and might, now seemed cold and unforgiving, like the walls of a penitentiary. The incriminated cadets, many of whom had left for summer duties, were called back and confined to barracks, virtually under house arrest. Reporters had sniffed the faint scent of scandal and had begun visiting the academy looking for leaks. At the end of that week, Blake appeared before what amounted to a final review board, a high-level panel consisting of two retired generals and learned hand the distinguished federal appeals court judge who had retired that May from regular bench duty in New York City. The Hand Board stayed at West Point for 2 days, reviewed earlier findings, interviewed cadets, and heard out Blake. The coach left his session encouraged by a statement from one of the retired generals that his